Hello, and welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We release these episodes every week on Wednesday mornings, and the best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you are listening. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via Venmo by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can make a donation through our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, by clicking the Donate tab. And one final announcement, we are very excited to offer the Wild Heart Labor Day Weekend Loving Kindness Retreat at Heartwood Refuge in Hendersonville, North Carolina, on September 3rd through the 6th. If you'd like more information about this retreat, please visit wildheartmeditationcenter.org and click the Events tab, or you can sign up and learn more at heartwoodrefuge.org. Peace and love. Hope you enjoy.
You know, of course, on the day where my nephews are in town staying at my house, 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, and I have a 2-year-old daughter, and I have a bacterial sinus infection and slept about 3 hours last night, the topic I have to give is on energy. And this is why I love having a service commitment, is because, like, sometimes it's more for me than it is for y'all, you know, like, helps me to really look at, like, okay, how do I want to use my energy skillfully today, you know, in the face of what the past 24 hours has been like for me? You know, what do I want to give my attention to today? How do I want to carry myself through my life today? It's a really good reflection, so maybe we can do that together. Myself and a co-teacher, Rachel Tanner Smith, who alternates Sunday mornings with me, we've been walking through something called the 10 Paramis for the past few weeks. And our friend Don, I don't think he's here today, but he filled in for us last week and talked about insight and wisdom. And today we're talking about energy or effort. The 10 Paramis are sometimes translated as the 10 Perfections. I've heard them called the Perfections of the Heart. You know, none of us like a list of 10 things that we have to be perfect at. So these are really the things that are the core principles, the guiding principles of the Buddhist teaching. And it's said that he practiced for multiple, countless lifetimes trying to perfect these in his own heart and mind. And so they're more of our aspirations and our kind of guiding stars for our practice than they are things that we're ever going to be perfect at. The reason why I love this list, though, is that I feel like something I really value about the Dharma, the Buddhist teaching, is that it all seems very practical for me. Like, when I read through this list, I don't feel like there's any of these factors or principles that I would be like, nah, that one's not important. You know, like, they all seem pretty central to the way I want to live my life. And so I'll read through them. They're up on the board. The first is generosity, then ethical conduct or living with integrity, renunciation, wisdom or insight, energy or effort, patience, truthfulness, resolve or determination, kindness, and equanimity. And the word parami comes from the root of another word, paramam, which means priority. So I really like to think of these as the 10 priorities, the 10 things we want to prioritize in our spiritual path. Shortly after the Buddha's awakening, it's said that he sat under the Bodhi tree with this kind of resolve and determination to not get up until he had become fully enlightened, until he had realized and seen through the nature of consciousness. And he did that for several days, and he sat and he sat and he sat, and it's said that he was able to do it. He was able to realize this thing we call Nibbana. Some of us may have heard of Nirvana, right, the band. But Nibbana is a Pali cooking term. It's like Rachel Ray would have used the word Nibbana back in the day. And it literally means to bring a boiling pot of water off the fire to let it settle. So this type of awakening that the Buddha realized was really the ceasing. It was the cooling down of reactivity in his mind. It wasn't the escape from pain. Pain is an inevitable part of our human consciousness, but it was the kind of releasing of reactivity around pain. It was also the releasing of craving and clinging around pleasure, a non-attached appreciation, an ability to be in pleasant experiences in a balanced way, in a joyful way without attachment. And so the Buddha had this realization, and then he was like, well, fuck, what am I going to do now, right? I'm like perfectly enlightened, and I just, you know, like woke up, and I don't have any more reactivity. I still have pain, and there's still loss, and there's sometimes I get what I want, and sometimes I get what I don't want, like all human beings, but there's not so much attachment and aversion and hatred that arises. And so what do I do now? And at first, his heart kind of inclined towards compassion, right? He was like, well, maybe I should share and teach and offer these practices to other people to help them. But then he thought about all the hard work that went into his practice. You know, he thought about how he left home when he was a kid and he had to renounce his privilege, and he was a homeless wanderer for years, and he went through all these meditative disciplines, and you know, all the sacrifices that he made came to his mind, the countless hours of meditation came to his mind, the immense amount of dedication he had to living ethically. He you know, wasn't engaging in sexuality and handling money and eating only the food that was being offered to him. And he was kind of like, shit, no one's going to listen to this. You know, no one's going to want to do this work. And so in the sutta, I want to read it because it's really interesting. I think it shows a lot of the Buddha's humanity after his enlightenment. It's called The Noble Quest. This is what he said. He said, why should I now reveal to others what I have reached through difficulty? This dharma, or this truth that I've realized, the ceasing of reactivity, is not easily awoken to by those that thrall in desire and hatred. Those dyed by desire, covered by a mass of darkness, will not see what goes against the stream, subtle, deep, hard to see and find. Were I to teach the Dharma, and others were not to understand me, that would be tiring and vexing for me. Right, so the Buddha is basically saying, like, this is going to be exhausting if I try to teach this. And I think actually many of us can empathize with the Buddha here. You know, like being on the receiving end of this, I'm like, God, the Buddha was an asshole. He didn't want to teach me? You know, like a little bit of disappointment. But if I actually put myself in his shoes, I've been in that space before. You know, sometimes I think many of us have put a lot of work into getting ourselves to a place where we're trying to live in line with what we value and the amount of commitment it's taken to get there. You know, like even coming here, how many people think about coming to the meditation center before they come? You know, like how many people want to really spend their Sunday morning at the meditation center sitting in silence with a bunch of other weirdos, right? Like not, you know, it takes a lot of sacrifice, you know? There's so many more fun things I could be doing with my time right now. I know a lot of people in here are in recovery, right? Like think about the dedication and the commitment, like all the times that you've had to sit through the cravings and like the impulses to use and the breakups and all the shit that happens in our life and just like not picking up drugs and alcohol no matter what, right? Like, and then you're trying to talk to someone that's on day one and you're like, fuck. Just stay put, you know, just don't use, just call me. You don't even really know what to say. You're like, just try to make it through today. And so I think we can empathize. You know, we a lot of us have worked our asses off to try to be the healthiest versions of ourselves that we can. And I do think that we're all doing our best in a lot of ways, right? And that we're also trying to do better in a lot of ways at the same time. So we've had to untangle some deep stuff, you know, a lot of our negative core beliefs about our worthiness and our deservingness for love and the endless amount of criticism and judgment from the mind, you know, and core shame about our inadequacy. And the Buddhist path is really interesting because it's not really a path of improving the self. It's really a path of seeing that there was nothing that needed to be improved in the first place. You know, it's really a path of self-acceptance, not self-improvement. And when we accept ourselves fully and all of our flaws and all of the difficulties and the ways that we've reacted in our lives, we see that every time we've reacted has come as a way to try to cope with life on life's terms. And it doesn't mean that we don't try to take responsibility. It means the opposite. We try to take responsibility, but to realize that any way that we've caused harm in our lives and lives of others have been a reaction to try to cope with pain. And so when we stop fighting and we start to really invite ourselves to feel our pain and to share our pain and to be vulnerable with it, we come to a place of greater acceptance. So it's not really about self-improvement, it's about self-acceptance, the Buddhist path at least. And so that's hard work, right? Once you do the deep digging and you reflect on your path and what it took to get where you're at today, you sometimes may be a little bit doubtful about supporting others and sharing with others. But then the Buddha finally said, he had this kind of clarity, and I think we feel this way as well. He said, but there are those with little dust in their eyes, right? There are those that are in a place in their life where maybe they've hit bottom or are desperate enough or have enough of a sense of the importance of personal responsibility that if you share with them these teachings and these practices, that they will listen, you know, that they might take them on and they might practice them. And I like to think that anyone that, I mean, because it is a weird thing to be like, oh, I'm even interested in meditation, you know, and to be here, I really think that this, what the Buddha is talking about, those people with little dust in our eyes are us, you know, and not to compare, but just to say that there are tons of people out there that never once have thought about sitting quietly with themselves in a room, you know, and we're always with ourselves, but so many of us have never even considered taking the time to sit and to see what happens in the mind and body when we observe it. So I like to think, you know, that we're those people with maybe a little dust in our eyes. There's something that speaks to us, even the idea of meditation, like maybe the possibility of what it might help, how it might support me in my life. That's what brings us here in some ways. So the Buddha then reflected on these five, you know, the Theravada Buddhists, our lineage, are big, we're list worshippers, we're big fans of different lists. So I already gave you all one of 10, and now I'm going to give you one of 5. He reflected on the core kind of principles that supported him along his way. And sure, these are the 10 paramis, but the 5 he reflected on after his enlightenment were called the 5 spiritual faculties, the 5 indriya. And their faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Now, I call faith the F word because it's not something, especially if you find yourself in a room of Buddhists, that you probably have the best relationship with. Most of us didn't grow up Buddhist, right? So we're here in some ways, usually in some kind of reaction to something else. You know what I mean? Like, let's be real. So faith isn't always something that feels very foundational to the Buddha's teaching. But the faith in Buddhism is interesting. It comes from this word sada, which actually means something more like confidence. And the Buddha really encourages us to not... he says that the salvation that he teaches, the liberation that comes through this path, can only be gained through our own efforts and endeavors, that our salvation is really won through our hard work and taking personal responsibility and training the heart and mind and wisdom and compassion. That there's no external refuge, he says. There's nothing outside of ourselves to look to as our ultimate salvation. He's not saying we shouldn't rely on people. He's not even saying that we should discount God. He has no opinions about God, whether God exists or doesn't exist. What he does care about is how we train our hearts and minds to see more clearly and respond more wisely to life on life's terms in the moment. He doesn't want us to be Buddhists. He wants us to be Buddhas, ultimately. So the Buddha empowers us and he says, you know, don't be a follower of me. He says literally in his dying words, be a light unto yourself, be an island unto yourself, seek no external refuge. Like ultimately, we've got to do the work ourselves at some point. And that, to me, feels really empowering. It doesn't feel, you know, judgmental and critical. It feels like you can do this, not why aren't you doing this? And so faith in the Buddhist tradition is this kind of empowering sense that each one of us has the potential and the power to wake up. Rachel will talk about in a couple weeks this other parami of resolve and determination that's coming up on the list. But I wanted to share about the confidence that the Buddha felt before his awakening, right at the moment when he decided to sit down under the Bodhi tree and not get up. He said this: "Let only my skin and bones remain. Let my blood dry up. I will not give up until I have accomplished what can be done by human effort and endeavor." And so this is that type of confidence that the Buddha had, this resolve. So if we back up a moment, like, what gets us to that place of confidence? I think some of it is if you've been coming for a while, or if you've done some therapeutic work, or you've been introduced to mindfulness in some ways. The cool thing about the practice is that we're not asking ourselves to believe in anything that we can't verify ourselves through the practice. And I love that. It's like, I learned that in recovery too. Like, they weren't asking me to believe in anything outside of when I put into action the principles of my recovery, I see that only I and other people benefit, right? It's verified faith. But then there comes that time, if you back up, before we get to that place of having something, some tools or some resources or some practices to take refuge in, usually we're just propelled into action out of desperation, right? And we call this the gift of desperation. They actually have this in Buddhism as well. They call it Samvega, which means spiritual urgency. So this is like existential crisis, right? This is like bottoming out. Like, even in Buddhism, they have this word, spiritual urgency, literally like the gift of desperation. And for the Buddha, it was wandering into the village and seeing people sick and dying, and elderly people uncared for, people ignoring and going about their day. You know, like we see this all over the media and the world and all the issues, and we see it, and there's just this like, what the fuck is going on, you know? That kind of urgency, we have to turn to some type of place, right, to help to support us in finding a way out, you know, finding a way to come together, you know, finding a way to support us in our mental health and in our societal health and so on and so forth. So we don't get to faith, what I'm saying is by having this optimistic kind of blind belief that this is going to work out. We usually get to it out of desperation. As Bhikkhu Bodhi says in his book, The Noble Eightfold Path, he says, "The search for a spiritual path does not start with lights and ecstasy, but with the hard tracks of pain, disappointment, and confusion." You know, why do we practice mindfulness? Chronic pain, anxiety, depression, you know, the relentless distraction of the thinking mind. We practice it out of some form of pain, some form of disappointment or confusion. You know, and even in Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey, he talks about crossing the threshold, that there's kind of this moment when you're in desperation that you take this leap of faith. I love this moment. I hate this moment when I'm in it, but I love this moment because there's nothing intellectual that can get you through it. And I used to rely so heavily on my intellect. You know, I used to be like, read all the philosophy books and be like, oh, life is meaningless, or every moment is full of meaning, or, you know, whatever, just like battle. Like, somehow trying to kind of remove myself from my inherent vulnerability that, like, I don't really know what's going on, that I'm just always perpetually in this moment all over again, and I'm not in control of shit. And that moment where, out of desperation, you just have to kind of put yourself out there. You just have to, like, try something and take the leap of faith. And so there is this faith in the beginning that's just kind of blind faith. And Buddhists really don't like this part of it because it sounds a lot like other religious traditions. And, we're, you know, it's kind of scary. It's like, you know, I don't know. I'm just going to have to try it. I'm just going to have to kind of believe in it because what I've been doing hasn't worked. And I would just say for those that are like myself, I like the verified faith and what I have confidence in through my own evidence. But all I've ever done up to this point is all I've known. And sometimes you need to do something that you don't know, you know, and that takes that leap of faith and that moment to cross over the threshold. And so once we have some faith and once we take that leap and then once we put the work in, faith or that sense of inspiration, confidence that's built through our spiritual path or through these practices, it gives rise to energy. This is an interesting thing because I work a lot with people as a therapist, and one of the number one things that I see is people knowing what they need to do but not being able to do it. You know, like coming in my office week after week, I share about this all the time, and saying like, I want to change this habit. I need to stop doing this thing. I want to do this instead. They already know what they want to do, but it's hard to change a habit when you're still caught in that kind of comfort with it, the familiarity of it. You know, so we know it's causing suffering, but we're not yet sure what will replace it, if it will be better. You know, we're not ready to take the leap of faith. And so I think that motivation has to come from some sort of inspiration or some sort of sense that, like, it can be better than this. Any habit that I'm stuck in my life, and I have plenty of them still, you know what I mean? I have to kind of know, I can have more freedom than this. Like, life can be more than, you know, binge-watching whatever on Netflix or smoking the vape, or not to judge those things, but to know that these kind of simple comforts of our habits aren't ultimately fulfilling. You know, they're not what we're living for. And we don't have to be moralistic about judging them as good or bad. We just really have to actually look. That's the thing about the Buddha's teaching that's so amazing, is he's not trying to even say this is right and this is wrong. He's saying you get to be the judge of that. But what you do have to do is really take an honest look at your habits. And when we do that, we kind of get the confidence of like, wow, this is really fucking me up. You know, this is really causing unnecessary stress. It's causing me to dissociate from my life. It's causing me to avoid aspects of my life. And more freedom is possible. That's a hard place to get to. But with some sort of inspiration, by having a community, by having a practice, slowly over time, I think we start to get that energy. That energy starts to arise, and that's a really great place, and we've all been in that place too, right? Where you finally get the motivation and you start to make the change. In Pali Sanskrit, the word for energy, virya, it's translated as energy or effort, but it has the same kind of root word as the Sanskrit. Someone may know this better than I do because I'm not a Sanskrit guy, but what is it in yoga? Virabhadrasana, which is warrior's pose, right? So energy means kind of this kind of warrior energy. It's kind of like courage. That's what energy means. Wise energy or right effort, right energy, wise energy, balanced energy are part of the Buddha's Eightfold Path as well. It's the sixth factor of the Buddha's Eightfold Path. It's said that the Buddha talked about this path factor more than any other factor of the Eightfold Path. So if you comb through all of the discourses, the Buddha talked about balanced energy and effort more than anything else. The word before energy, before virya in the Eightfold Path, is this word sama. And sama is an interesting word. We've translated as right, like right view, right intention, right speech, right action. But you know how well we do with right and wrong. And it actually means something more like complete or balanced or harmonious. So it means holistic. So what we're trying to do with our energy is not have right energy, but we're trying to have a balanced energy. We're trying to have a wise relationship with our energy. And the interesting thing about this is that when we don't have a wise relationship with where we put our energy, it saps our energy. So if we pay too much attention to things that aren't, you know, leading in the direction of our welfare and happiness, they tend to actually sap our energy. Lethargy is a result. And the Buddha says this in the five hindrances. He talks about one of the causes for lethargy being unwise attention. You know, we know this because I've experienced depression throughout my life. And usually what happens is there's this kind of like, you know how people describe depression as almost comfortable? Isn't that interesting? This kind of like, there's almost like this warm blanket feeling to it. It's like as I withdraw from my life into the comfort of my habits and my energy starts going into those places, that lack of motivation, that kind of despondency and that shutdownness, the isolation, the withdrawal, the lethargy starts to set in. And so I love what Pema Chodron says about looking at lethargy. She says that we don't want to condemn, we don't want to ignore, and we don't want to indulge in our lethargy. And this is really the path of Buddhism that's kind of a pain in the ass. It's like, it's not so simple as to say, I need to stop being so lazy. Yeah, because there's too much taking personally something that's more energetic than it is says anything about you. You know, it's too much of ourselves that we're attaching to this mind state. We've got to really look at what's feeding it. You know, what's fueling it? Where is our energy going? So we can't condemn our laziness. We have to be curious about it. And we can't indulge in it either, because if we just ignore it, then we keep doing it. And this is where the middle path and having this balance or this idea of a balanced energy is much more complicated than just saying, here's the list of commandments and do this, that, and the other, and you'll be good. It's saying, no, the responsibility is on your shoulders. You've got to like investigate it. So important to know that this path, the Buddhist path, you know, he practiced for, I think it was 7 years. I don't remember the exact number, but and he was pretty hardcore. You know what I mean? I've been practicing 10 years. I don't think I'm anywhere around where the Buddha was after seven. But to just kind of know that this is more of a discipline than it is a race to the finish. You know, even when you meditate, you're not really trying to get anywhere because you're not trying to change your state of mind. That's just the same thing we try to do out there, you know, like feel better by changing our state. We're trying to become intimate with our state of mind. So it's all about observation. It's about awareness. It's not about fixing or changing how we feel. It's about experiencing it authentically, honestly, openly, with awareness. And so what I like to say is, you know, someone asked the Dalai Lama one time, how do you know, he said this, and then someone was like, but how do you know if you're like making progress? You know, like, come on, you got to tell me a little bit, like, how do you know if it's going right? He says, you should check in with your practice about once every 10 years. That's what the Dalai Lama said. So I just, you know, I'm about 10 or 11 years into this. It's like, okay, how am I doing? You know, like, wow, big difference in 10 years. You know, I think I'm going the right direction. Because on any given year, right, we could have COVID and depression and breakups. And like, your feelings aren't a good indicator of how you're doing, ever. And feelings are impermanent, they're impersonal, and they're imperfect. They mean nothing about you. So if we judge our practice and our progress by how we feel, it's probably the worst thing we could do. We have to look at a longer scope of time. And this is just all to say that we're balancing our energy and our kind of approach to our practice. Is think of it as a discipline. And I like the word discipline because it has the root word disciple in it. And disciple means both, in Latin, it means both student and teacher. So your practice itself is your teacher, but also you're a student of those moments when you step away from it. It will teach you something about it. You know, why am I not meditating? Let's remove that part of self-judgment and actually be curious. You know, oh, there's a lot of pain You know, there's a lot of restlessness, there's a lot of confusion, and that's really uncomfortable to sit with. That's not why I'm not sitting. So our effort, our energy can be more about curiosity and our discipline than it has to be about our practice always looking a certain way. Does that make sense? Second thing I want to say real quick is is about our effort in the meditation itself, our effort to be mindful. You know, the word mindfulness, satipatthana, means, sati actually means, it means something more like memory, which is interesting. Mindfulness is an 18th century Christian terminology. You know, it wasn't even an old school Christian term. It was kind of a new school one. And I think it's actually an okay term, but when you really look at the word, it means something like to remember the ground. That's what satipatthana means. So mindfulness is that experience you have when you're meditating and your mind wanders off and you kind of wake up and realize it and you're like, oh. And then you remember to come back to the present. You remember that, oh, that's actually a future thought. That's not real. That's the mind projecting. Or when the mind's living in the past and you're like, oh, that's not actually here anymore. It only exists as a memory. And you come to that awareness that this is just the mind thinking. That type of awareness and then that memory to come back to the present, that's what mindfulness means. It means to remember the ground, to remember to keep coming back here right now. And that type of effort needs to be gentle. You know, we can't be rigid. We're not going to be present 100% of the time. Your attention has been following your thoughts and your conceptual thoughts for your whole life. They even know that the default mode network of your brain, like what your brain is doing when at rest, when not engaged in task, is it's following thoughts. So your attention is addicted to thinking. And you didn't choose that. You didn't say, go after every thought. But after doing it for so long, and our species being anxious and constantly trying to prepare and anticipate threats and handle conflicts so we don't get cast out of the tribe, so constantly judging and comparing and planning and analyzing, that's what our species have been doing for thousands of years. We're not going to sit down and meditate and get rid of that. But we can start to pull our attention back to the present, you know, and with this gentle energy or effort, this balanced effort, we continue to come back. And as we practice, that ability gets stronger. You know, the ability to be in the present moment starts to, that habit starts to get created. So the Buddha talked about balancing your energy during meditation, like training or tuning a guitar. He says if it's too tight, if your attention is too rigid. I remember when I first started meditating, I was suffering so bad. I was like, I'm going to nail the breath to the floor. You know, like my teacher Dave used to say all the time, just nail it to the floor. And I really thought I was going to just be so present. And you know what that did is it just made my mind more agitated. And so then, you know, there are times where I'm like, I'm just going to sit down, bring no intention to the meditation at all. I just kind of wait for the bell, you know, like I set my timer. I'm like, all right, I can just sit here for 15 minutes and just wait. You know, I'm not even really being curious. I'm not even trying to kind of attend to the present moment. I'm just kind of sitting there waiting for the bell to ring. So finding that balance is like tuning an instrument. If there's too much rigidity, it's too sharp. There's too much agitation in your meditation. If there's not enough curiosity, if there's not enough interest, it's too loose. The mind's too dull. So that's constant. We're always working with energy. All right, last thing I want to share real quick is, you know, what is the goal of this spiritual path, you know, of this path. Like I said at the beginning, it's about cooling down the reactivity of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, when the Buddha says that the sacrifices he had to make and all the times meditating and all that he had to do, he said that it was going against the stream of greed, hatred, and delusion. And if we don't have to get caught in the hyperbole of those words, they sound really dramatic, but if you just look at, like, when you sit down and meditate and your mind is like wanting to do anything other than that, we call that greed. Anticipation, wanting something to be different, longing for something other than what's happening in this moment, a moment of stimulation. You know that feeling when you're like sitting with friends and your hand goes for the phone? You know, don't take that personally. That's the habit energy. You know, we call that sankhara in Buddhism. It's just been practiced so much, that craving for stimulation, that the attention goes to it. So we call that greed, or we call that tanha, this thirst, this kind of craving for stimulation. And when we're also trying to cool down the reactivity of hatred, and this is really tricky, and this is the balancing factor of our practice too, that the Buddha says that hatred doesn't cease by hatred. You can't hate yourself into being a better person. You can't hate other people into being better people. And the Buddha's really not bargaining with this one, y'all. And like, I know that like anger is valid in the face of injustice, but anger and hatred are different. And when we say, I hate that person, that hating does not lead to the ceasing of hatred. Resentment is a poison. The Buddha calls it a honey-tipped dart. He says that it tastes sweet. We like to vent. We like to talk shit. We like to gossip and hate. But it sticks real deep, you know, because what it does is it gets us lost in this delusion that there are those people and there are us. And that's what causes the problems to begin with. You know what I mean? And so once we get caught in that kind of delusion of separateness, we can then have an enemy. And when we have an enemy, we walk around defending. And you can't have an open heart and a liberated heart and a defended heart at the same time. So anger is valid in the face of injustice. We're not saying don't be angry, but we have to channel that energy into something wholesome. You know, and Howard Zinn talks about this. He says, you know, like if we choose to focus on those times, and he says there have been so many times where people have behaved magnificently, where we have behaved magnificently in the face of adversity, in the face of pain and oppression and suffering. If we choose to emphasize those times, then we can have the motivation, the energy to do something good for the world. And he says, and even if you can just do your small part, you're doing something magnificent for the world. And so hatred doesn't cease by hatred. We have to uproot that, right? And apply the energy to really watch our mind, to bring wisdom to our anger and to say, all right, where do you want to move me towards, you know? And then the third poison is delusion. And this is this kind of delusion, like I said earlier, of self and other. You know, that they're on an ultimate level, there's no distinction between you and me. On an ultimate level, your happiness is my happiness. You know, so if I focus on my happiness, I'm focusing on your happiness. If I focus on supporting you and your happiness, I'm focusing on my happiness too. In the relative level, I have a conventional sense of self. Yes, there's a me and there's a you. But in the ultimate level, there's just this delusion, you know, that there are people that are up here and people that are down here. You know, when your mind does that, when you walk in a room of people, it's like the mind automatically organizes you in your place. It's like, if you're new here, it's like, oh man, you're way at the bottom. I don't know shit about meditation. All these people are experts, you know? Delusion. None of us know shit about meditation. As soon as you think you do, you're fucked. Right? Almost the longer you've been doing it, the worse it is for you. So just in terms of giving you that kind of like sense of ego, right? In Zen Buddhism, they say in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the experts, there are few. So be a beginner's mind. Know that we're all in this together. That helps to uproot the delusion. And so, and I won't go into it, but the Eightfold Path factor, the sixth factor of wise effort, is all about using mindfulness to try to prevent these unwholesome mind states from arising, to learn how to abandon them when they do, to try to cultivate wholesome or skillful mind states, like kindness and compassion and gratitude and equanimity, and to try to maintain those mind states. So why do we meditate? So we can learn to have discernment, not judgment, but discernment around our mind states, and to try to cultivate a mind that is living in line with an awakened heart in an awakened world. And if we can just do our small part, you know, the it starts here. You know, we're doing something good for the world. So I'll stop there for today. We've got plenty of time. We've got about 15 minutes. Would love to just open it up. The only guidelines for sharing is please use personal statements. So don't crosstalk and share at other people or give other people advice. You know, try to keep your share limited to maybe like 3 minutes or so, just in case more people want to share. But other than that, whether you're new or you've been coming forever, please feel free. You know, this is just time to kind of check in and see what comes up around this topic of effort and energy. Thanks for listening.